Picture this for a second. You are standing at the front of a room.
Or, staring into that little green webcam light on your laptop.
Yes, exactly. That cold, unblinking green light.
Yeah.
And you have spent hours preparing.
You've got the slide deck loaded up. It looks fantastic.
Right. And you have a video clip ready to play to illustrate your main point. You've even got this interactive poll queued up on a totally different platform.
Just to keep the audience engaged, of course.
Exactly. And you've got the audience itself. Maybe they are sitting in rows, or maybe they're just trapped in those little grid boxes on your screen.
Waiting for you to start.
So you
Yeah.
take a breath, you hit share screen, and the video just freezes.
The absolute worst feeling.
It is. The audio drops into this, like, a robotic stutter. Someone accidentally unmutes, and suddenly you're treated to the sound of a blender or a dog barking frantically in the background.
You look at the audience, and all you see is a sea of blank, disconnected stares.
In that exact fraction of a second, your heart rate spikes. Your palms start to sweat.
Cortisol just floods your system.
Your brain completely scrambles,
Yeah.
and you realize something utterly terrifying in that moment.
Yeah.
Knowing your material inside and out isn't going to save you.
It really is a profoundly modern kind of paralysis, because in that moment, the task you're doing has fundamentally changed.
Right, you aren't teaching anymore.
Exactly. You are no longer just delivering information. You have suddenly become an IT troubleshooter. You're a crisis manager.
You're an entertainer trying to win back a lost crowd.
And, crucial to our deep dive today, you are an emotional regulator trying to suppress your own rising panic. The sheer volume of sensory and social data flooding your prefrontal cortex in that frozen moment is just staggering.
You realize knowing your material just isn't enough. And that panic, that exact modern terror, is what led us to the fascinating stack of research we are unpacking today.
It is a really incredible study.
We're diving into a comprehensive paper focused on English language teachers. It's titled "The Role of Social-Emotional Competence in Managing Multimodal Classroom Instruction," a gender-based comparative study in ELT teacher training.
It's a mouthful of a title, for sure.
It is. Now, you might be thinking, I don't teach English, so why should I care? But the core of this research is really about surviving the absolute chaos of what academics call the multimodal environment.
Which applies to almost all of us now.
Exactly. It is about understanding why technical skills alone are completely failing us in the modern workplace. And we are going to explore how emotional intelligence acts as this hidden psychological operating system preventing total cognitive meltdown.
Plus, we'll look at the really fascinating role that gender socialization plays in all of this.
Okay, let's unpack this. What stands out immediately in this research to me is the radical shift in perspective.
Yes, historically, when researchers look at technology in learning or communication, the lens is almost exclusively trained on the receiver.
Right. We ask endless questions about the student or the audience.
Exactly. We ask, how is the screen time affecting their attention span? Are the interactive elements actually improving their attention? Are they distracted by the chat box?
The assumption is always that the technology is there to serve the learner, and the teacher is just, well, the delivery mechanism.
But this study pivots the camera entirely. It focuses entirely on the person behind the podium or, behind the webcam.
It asks how the human being orchestrating all of this technology is actually surviving the experience.
We are looking at the emotional toll and the psychological endurance required to juggle digital and traditional communication simultaneously.
Which brings us to this concept of the multimodal minefield. The study focuses on English language teaching, or ELT, and it defines multimodal instruction as the simultaneous integration of linguistic, visual, auditory, and digital resources.
But let's pause on that, because multimodal sounds like a very clean corporate buzzword.
It really does, like something you'd see on a sleek training brochure.
Right, but in reality, what does that actually look like for the human brain? Why is this specific cocktail of inputs so exhausting to manage?
To understand that exhaustion, the paper leans heavily on Mayer's multimodal learning theory.
Right, so if you picture a highly traditional teaching environment, say a lecture hall from 50 years ago.
Just a professor and a chalkboard.
Exactly. The instruction is primarily linguistic and linear. A person speaks and you listen. Maybe they write a single word on the board. The information is flowing through a single manageable channel.
But in a multimodal environment, you are attacking the brain from multiple angles at once. You have text on a screen.
You have a voice explaining a concept that might be slightly different from the text itself.
Right. You have a dynamic visual diagram. And you probably have a digital prompt asking the user to click a response.
For the learner, that setup actually sounds great. If I zone out while you're talking, I can just read the slide.
If I don't understand the slide, I can look at the diagram. It is like providing five different doors into the exact same room.
It is highly effective for the learner, yes. And providing those multiple doors is especially vital in language learning. Acquiring a new language is not just some vocabulary memorization exercise.
It's highly contextual, right?
Very. It requires understanding tone, facial expressions, and cultural nuance. And most importantly, it is a profoundly vulnerable experience.
Oh, absolutely. Trying to speak a language you haven't mastered makes you feel stripped of your intelligence.
You feel exposed, like your personality is just erased. So providing visuals and audio cues helps bridge the gap when words fail them, which really lowers that anxiety.
But the cost of building those five doors falls entirely on the teacher.
Exactly. While the multiple modes of representation increase access and lower anxiety for the student, they exponentially increase the cognitive and emotional burden on the instructor.
The instructor is no longer just a solo performer delivering a monologue.
They are monitoring the slide deck to ensure it syncs with their speech. They are scanning the faces in the room to gauge comprehension.
They are anticipating the inevitable software glitch.
And they are managing the complex social dynamics of 30 different people all at once. The cognitive load isn't just doubled, it is multiplicative.
So if traditional teaching is like playing a solo acoustic guitar, I mean, it might be hard to play, but you only have to worry about your two hands and six strings.
Right.
Multimodal teaching is like trying to conduct a full digital orchestra. You have a brass section, a string section, a synthesizer, and a light show.
And halfway through the performance, someone randomly unplugs the bass amps?
Yes. The lights go dark and the audience starts yelling. You're trying to keep the rhythm going while the stage is essentially on fire.
It's a miracle anyone can do it.
And the wildest part to me is how we actually train people for this scenario. If I'm reading the paper's critique of current training programs, right, we spend all our time showing teachers how to use the lighting board and plug in the amps.
We call it digital literacy. We obsess over the mechanics.
Right. We teach them the software.
Teacher education, and frankly corporate training as well, invests heavily in teaching the software. Trainees are taught which buttons to push, how to format the interactive whiteboard, how to integrate the video link seamlessly.
They are taught the methodology of the content itself.
But the gaping hole in this training, the massive disconnect this study highlights, is the complete neglect of the emotional endurance required.
The endurance required to actually use those mechanics when the environment inevitably degrades.
We teach the ideal scenario. We teach them how to conduct the orchestra when every single instrument is perfectly in tune.
But we spend almost zero time on the emotional tools required when the instruments fail and the human beings in the room become frustrated.
The paper uses a phrase that feels incredibly visceral. It says that without emotional grounding, instruction becomes fragmented and confusing.
Fragmented, that is the perfect word. If the digital orchestra starts falling apart and the conductor panics, the music just stops.
They might know the sheet music perfectly. They might have a PhD in music theory.
But if their heart is pounding out of their chest and they're visibly angry at the broken amp, the learning environment just collapses.
Because when the cognitive load hits its threshold and the inevitable friction occurs, a broken link, a confused student, a sudden loss of internet connection, the instructor without an emotional anchor will fragment.
They lose their train of thought. Their pacing becomes erratic.
They might snap at a student or become visibly flustered, and the students instantly pick up on that stress.
Their own anxiety spikes.
Exactly. And the pedagogical goal is completely lost. The technology, which was supposed to enhance the learning, becomes the very thing that destroys it.
Which brings us to the core mechanism the researchers propose to stop this fragmentation. Social-emotional competence, or SEC?
Yes, SEC is the shield here.
But I want to clarify something right away. Because whenever the phrase emotional intelligence or competence comes up, I think a lot of people immediately dismiss it as a fixed personality trait.
They assume someone is either naturally a calm, empathetic, zen-like person, or they are just highly strung and nervous.
Right. It feels like an innate quirk. If I'm an anxious person, I hear social-emotional competence, and I think, well, I guess I'm just doomed to be a fragmented teacher.
The research vehemently pushes back against that essentialist view. The study frames SEC not as an innate quirk or a fixed personality trait, but as a highly dynamic developmental professional competence.
It is a skill set, just like typing or using Excel.
Exactly. Just as you can learn to use a complex software suite, you can learn and actively develop the cognitive and emotional pathways required to manage a chaotic room.
So to make this actionable, the researchers break SEC down into three distinct, measurable components within the context of their study. Let's pull those apart because they aren't just buzzwords.
The first is emotion regulation. In this context, it is the deliberate capacity to monitor, evaluate, and modify your own internal stress response.
It's the ability to feel that spike of cortisol when the video freezes.
And consciously intercept the panic before it manifests as erratic behavior.
Okay, what's the second component?
The second is empathy. And here, empathy isn't just a vague feeling of warmth. It is an active cognitive process.
Like reading the room.
Right. It is the sensitivity to the learner's affective states. Scanning the room and actively recognizing, oh, the students are feeling overwhelmed by this visual, or their linguistic vulnerability is peaking right now.
And the third?
The third component is interpersonal communication. This is the execution phase. It is the ability to maintain clear, adaptive, supportive social exchanges.
Basically, guiding the room through the friction, even when your own cognitive load is totally maxed out.
Precisely. Okay, so the researchers map these three components out in a conceptual model in the text.
And this is where I need you to translate the academic architecture for me. They define SEC as a mediator.
Yes, a mediator.
I always get mediator and moderator confused. I know one changes things and one is a pathway, but how does this actually apply to the frozen video scenario?
Let's use an engineering analogy. Think of a car driving down a road.
Okay, I'm with you.
The multimodal demands, the technology glitches, the confused students, the complex software are the potholes in the road. They are inevitable obstacles.
Right.
The teaching outcome, whether the students actually learn anything or just end up confused and stressed, is the passenger in the car. If you hit a massive pothole, the passenger gets thrown around, maybe they hit their head, and the ride is ruined.
So where does moderator fit into this?
A moderator would be something like the speed of the car. It changes the strength of the impact. If you hit the pothole going slowly, it's less jarring than if you hit it going fast.
We'll talk about gender as a moderator later.
Right.
Yes. The study looks at gender as a moderator later on, meaning the way these skills look might change depending on social conditioning.
Mm.
But SEC is positioned as the mediator.
So what is the mediator in the car?
The mediator is the suspension system of the car.
Oh, that makes total sense. The pothole still exists. The car still hits it.
But the impact has to travel through the suspension system before it reaches the passenger.
If the suspension system is robust, if the instructor has high social emotional competence, the system absorbs the kinetic energy of the pothole. The shock doesn't transfer to the passenger.
So the researchers are arguing that multimodal instructional demands don't directly dictate whether a class succeeds or fails.
Exactly. All of that pressure, all of that digital chaos filters directly through the teacher's internal SEC suspension system.
So to put that into the classroom reality, the video fails to load. That is the pothole.
Right.
The teacher with a weak suspension system feels the jolt, panics, gets visibly frustrated with the computer, and the students feel the whiplash. The learning stops.
And the teacher with a robust SEC suspension system hits the exact same pothole, but their emotion regulation kicks in.
They take a breath. They suppress the urge to swear at the screen.
Their empathy scans the room and notices the students are getting distracted, and their interpersonal communication executes a smooth pivot.
They smile and say, "Looks like our digital orchestra is missing its brass section today. Let's pivot and discuss the themes in groups instead."
The pothole was hit, but the passengers barely felt a bump. That is the mediator effect perfectly articulated.
SEC prevents the instructional fragmentation. The lesson bends, but it doesn't break.
It's a beautiful way to frame it.
But, you know, having a great suspension system in theory is one thing. Building it in reality is another.
Very true.
It's incredibly easy to sit here and say, well, teachers just need to regulate their emotions. It sounds a bit like telling an angry person to just calm down.
Which is historically the least effective advice ever given.
Exactly. So how did the researchers actually test whether this suspension system could be manufactured in a real human being? Let's dive into the Safer Academy experiment.
The methodology here is rigorous and highly practical. The researchers conducted a quasi-experimental study at the Safer Language Academy.
And who were they studying?
They worked with 50 pre-service ELT trainees. To give you a profile of these participants, they were evenly split, 25 men and 25 women, ranging in age from 22 to 28.
So these are young adults. They grew up with technology.
Exactly. They have completed their foundational theoretical coursework. They know the grammar, they know the software, but they are still trainees. They haven't been hardened by years in a real classroom.
And the trial they put them through was not a multiple-choice test on their feelings.
Far from it. They put them through a 4-week instructional module specifically designed to test this multimodal environment.
How do they evaluate them?
They used a mix of quantitative surveys, like a Likert scale teacher SEC inventory before and after the training. But more importantly, they forced them to perform actual micro teaching lessons.
Micro teaching, that sounds intense.
It is. They had to stand up, integrate visuals, manage audio, run digital tools, and teach a highly contextual language lesson to real people, all while being scored on performance rubrics.
I can vividly imagine the sweat in that room. You are 24 years old, you're trying to teach a complex English grammar rule, your peers and evaluators are watching you with clipboards.
And you are trying to make sure your digital poll actually launches.
It is a complete pressure cooker. But the most crucial part of this experiment seems to be how they taught the SEC. They didn't just pull them into a circle on a Friday afternoon, hand out tea, and say, "Let's talk about our feelings."
No, and that is where most corporate and educational training fails. We treat emotional skills as an extracurricular activity.
Right, like a retreat exercise.
This study embedded the SEC activities directly into the multimodal tasks. The trainees weren't learning emotional regulation in a vacuum.
They were practicing deep breathing or cognitive reframing while they were simulating a digital whiteboard failure.
Exactly. They were practicing empathy-focused reflection while trying to manage a chaotic online chat room. The emotional skill was permanently tethered to the technical trigger.
It's essentially stress inoculation. You are putting them in the simulator, turning on the turbulence, and teaching them how to read the instruments while the alarms are blaring.
That's a perfect analogy.
Now, there is one detail in the methodology that I know statisticians usually flag. The paper mentions they used convenient sampling.
Yes, they did.
They essentially took the 50 students who happened to be enrolled in this specific academy course at this specific time.
Correct.
If I'm listening to this, and I want to know if these findings apply to my life, does the fact that they just used whoever was in the room invalidate the results?
It is a vital detail to scrutinize. Convenient sampling is a known limitation in research.
Meaning we can't generalize perfectly.
Right. It means we cannot take these 50 Iranian language trainees and definitively claim that their exact numerical outcomes will perfectly map onto, say, a 50-year-old corporate executive in Tokyo or a high school math teacher in Chicago. The sample is specific.
But the researchers knew this, right?
They anticipated this critique entirely and countered it with a highly rigorous mixed methods design. They didn't just look at one data point, they triangulated the data.
What does that mean in practice?
By pairing the hard numbers from the surveys and teaching rubrics with deep qualitative data, the trainees' own personal diaries and peer reviews, they established intense internal validity.
So we know the training caused the change.
We know for an absolute fact that the changes observed in this group were the direct result of the embedded training. The principles of the mechanism are incredibly solid, even if the exact metrics might shift in a different population.
All right, so we have the 50 trainees, we have the stress inoculation simulator, and we have the pre and post
The
tests.
setup is complete.
What happened to the suspension systems? Did the vegetable smoothie actually work?
The data reveals a massive, undeniable shift. Participation in the SEC-infused module resulted in statistically significant improvements across every single metric.
Give me the numbers.
If we look at the total SEC mean score for the entire group, it moved from 3.12 on the pretest to 3.78 on the post-test.
Now, to someone not reading academic papers daily, a jump of 0.6 on a 5-point scale might sound like they just went from a C to a C plus. It doesn't sound like a revolution.
I get that, but in the context of educational and psychological research, moving a behavioral metric by that margin in just 4 weeks is akin to a minor earthquake.
Really? Just 4 weeks?
Yes. To quantify exactly how impactful it was, the researchers calculated the effect size using Cohen's d.
Okay, I'm going to need a translation on Cohen's d.
So a standard p-value just tells you if a result is a mathematical fluke or not.
It tells you if the result is real.
Exactly. But an effect size tells you the magnitude. It tells you how practically meaningful the change is out in the real world. In the behavioral sciences, a Cohen's d of 0.2 is considered a small bump.
Okay.
A 0.5 is a medium noticeable difference, and a 0.8 is considered a large, highly visible effect.
And what was the effect size for these trainees after the 4 weeks?
The total SEC effect size was 1.34.
Wait, 1.34?
Yes. And the subdimensions of emotional regulation, empathy, and interpersonal communication all ranged from 1.11 to 1.27.
Wow. So it blew way past the 0.8 mark for a large effect.
Exactly. These are not subtle statistical murmurs. This represents a profound behavioral transformation. You are watching a group of individuals evolve from reactive, anxious participants into emotionally grounded, proactive managers of their environment.
It definitively proves the central hypothesis, then.
It proves that social-emotional competence is highly malleable. It is a muscle that responds rapidly to targeted resistance training. It is not fixed at birth.
And it wasn't just their self-reported feelings that improved, right? The actual quality of their teaching skyrocketed.
Right. The external evaluators scoring their micro-teaching rubrics saw huge jumps. The male trainees' performance scores leaped. The female trainees' scores leaped.
And here is the piece of the data that I think completely flips our modern understanding of professional training upside down.
What's that?
The paper explicitly notes that these 22 to 28-year-old trainees already entered the program with a high baseline of digital literacy.
They grew up with screens. They already knew how the software worked.
Exactly. But their ability to actually teach using that software was mediocre until they received the emotional training. Doesn't this imply that what we call soft skills are actually the hardest, most fundamental mechanics of any job?
It forces a complete reevaluation of that terminology. Calling emotional regulation a soft skill diminishes its structural importance.
It makes it sound optional.
Right. But the research explicitly states that a lack of SEC prevents the full realization of multimodal pedagogy. It acts as a strict bottleneck.
You can purchase the most expensive, frictionless software platform on the market.
And you can train an employee to know every keyboard shortcut by heart. But if they lack the internal regulation to handle the moment a client asks an unexpected question while the screen share glitches, all of that technical knowledge is instantly rendered useless.
The technology is entirely dependent on the human emotional competence to wield it.
Precisely.
So the training was a universal success. The suspension systems were upgraded across the board. But if everyone improves so dramatically, did the training work the exact same way for everyone?
That is a great question.
Did everyone lean on the exact same emotional crutches to survive the micro-teaching simulator?
That leads us to one of the most layered and potentially controversial aspects of the study.
The gender dimension.
Yes. The researchers ran an analysis of variance, or ANOVA, to see if there were statistically significant differences in the post-test scores based on gender.
And what did they find?
The data revealed a very distinct, nuanced split in how the male and female trainees were deploying their newly strengthened SEC.
Okay, let's look at the split.
Yeah.
Where did the female trainees score highest?
The female trainees demonstrated significantly higher scores in the subdimensions of empathy and interpersonal communication. The effect sizes here were large, with partial eta squared values of 0.21 and 0.18, respectively.
They were highly adept at reading the emotional state of the room and maintaining relational harmony.
Exactly.
And the male trainees.
The male trainees scored significantly higher in emotional regulation and classroom control. They demonstrated a stronger propensity for internalizing their stress and asserting authority to manage the chaotic environment.
Now, I have to jump in here, because the second I hear a study conclude that men are better at emotional regulation and control and women are better at empathy and communication, giant red warning sirens go off in my head.
Understandably so.
Because that sounds exactly like a script from a 1950s sitcom. It sounds like we are saying men are biologically hardwired to be stoic commanders who don't feel pain, and women are biologically hardwired to be sensitive nurturers.
Right.
If we aren't careful, this data just validates the oldest, most tired essentialist stereotypes we have. How do the researchers contextualize this so we don't fall into a biological trap?
The researchers are acutely aware of that trap, and they meticulously apply a non-essentialist sociocultural lens to the data.
So it's not about biology.
Not at all. If we go back to our car analogy, the study positions gender not as the engine of the car, but as a moderator. They firmly reject any notion of biological determinism regarding teaching capability.
What is the data actually reflecting then?
It is reflecting the profound impact of lifelong socialization and professional expectations.
So it's not nature, it's nurture on a massive systemic scale.
Precisely.
Yeah.
From a very early age, societal structures condition males and females differently regarding how they're supposed to handle stress, conflict, and authority. A male trainee might have been subtly or explicitly socialized his entire life to suppress outward signs of panic and to view leadership as the exertion of control over a chaotic space.
Therefore, under the extreme pressure of the multimodal micro-teaching, he instinctively reaches for the tool he has been conditioned to use.
Exactly. Emotional regulation and classroom control.
And a female trainee.
Conversely, a female trainee may have been socialized to prioritize relational harmony, to be highly attuned to the feelings of others, and to lead through consensus and connection.
So under pressure, she reaches for empathy and interpersonal communication.
Exactly.
It's like they're both trying to fix the engine of the car, but society handed them entirely different toolboxes at birth.
That's a great way to put it.
They're both successfully using SEC to mediate the chaos, but they're speaking different dialects of emotional intelligence.
Yes.
And if you are a teacher training program or a corporate HR department, recognizing these different starting lines is crucial. You can't just mandate a one-size-fits-all feelings workshop.
The researchers advocate strongly for gender-responsive pedagogical approaches.
Which doesn't mean separating people,
yeah.
Right?
No, not at all. This does not mean reinforcing the stereotypes. We do not want to tell the men to just focus on controlling the room while the women handle the emotional fallout.
No, that would just make it worse.
It means acknowledging the divergent baselines without a deficit mindset. A robust program needs to support male trainees in developing deeper empathic engagement and recognizing vulnerability,
while simultaneously supporting female trainees in developing assertive emotional regulation and authoritative classroom management strategies.
The goal is to help every individual build a complete holistic SEC profile rather than just relying on the tools society handed them.
Okay, we have dug deeply into the numbers, the ANOVAs, the effect sizes, the standard deviations.
There's a lot of math.
But numbers can be incredibly sterile. They tell us the what. They tell us the scores went up, and they tell us there's a gender difference.
But they don't tell us the how.
Exactly. To truly understand the how what this actually felt like for a 24-year-old standing in front of a broken interactive whiteboard, sweating through their shirt, we have to look at the qualitative data.
And the researchers didn't just crunch spreadsheets. They read the trainees' personal reflective diaries and peer feedback forms.
The qualitative thematic analysis is where the human element of the study truly shines.
The researchers read through all of these deeply personal reflections and extracted four dominant themes that perfectly triangulate the quantitative data.
Let's go through them. What was theme one?
Theme one was emotion regulation as a buffer against multimodal overload. In their diaries, the trainees explicitly narrated the sensation of their new internal suspension system working.
They could actually feel it working.
Yes. They wrote about the moment the technology failed, describing how, in the past, they would have completely lost their composure. But post-training, they felt a conscious, deliberate calmness.
They recognized the buffer actively absorbing the shock of the digital failure, allowing them to maintain their executive function.
It's the difference between being tossed out of a boat and knowing how to swim versus just drowning. You still feel the cold water, but you aren't panicking.
That is a brilliant analogy. What was the second theme?
Theme two was empathy-driven learner engagement. This is particularly poignant in the context of language teaching.
Because language learning is so vulnerable.
Right. Trainees wrote extensively about developing a heightened, almost visceral sensitivity to their students' anxiety. They explicitly recognized the linguistic vulnerability of their learners.
If you have a student who is already terrified of mispronouncing an English word, and suddenly the audio lags on the platform, that student might shut down completely.
Exactly. The trainees wrote about using their SEC to provide emotional scaffolding, adjusting their tone, providing encouraging nonverbal cues, and validating the difficulty of the multimodal task to keep the student engaged.
You know, if you're listening to this and you manage a remote team, this is the exact same skill you use when you notice your junior designer suddenly goes quiet on a massive team call.
After a confusing client feedback slide, maybe.
Exactly. It's the ability to read the silence and provide the scaffolding. Now, theme three, if I recall, maps perfectly onto the gender discussion we just had.
Yes. Theme three was gendered patterns of SEC expression. The diaries proved that the statistical split wasn't just a mathematical artifact. It was conscious behavior.
What did the women write about?
Female trainees frequently centered their reflections around relationships. They wrote about the joy of connecting with the struggling student or the importance of creating an inclusive digital atmosphere.
And the men.
Male trainees' journals were heavily focused on task completion and maintaining authority during disruptions. They wrote about the satisfaction of keeping the lesson on track, despite the software crashing. They were consciously aware of the specific tools they were using to survive.
It's fascinating to see the data play out in their own words, but it is theme four that I think is the ultimate payoff for everything we've discussed today.
Team four is incredible.
Theme four was SEC as a catalyst for instructional confidence. Before this training, the trainees were paralyzed by the multimodal environment.
But afterward, across the board, male and female, they reported a massive spike in their willingness to take risks.
Why is that confidence so important?
Confidence in a multimodal setting is entirely dependent on your belief in your ability to recover from failure. If you lack SEC, you will artificially limit your teaching.
You play it safe.
You avoid using a complex, highly engaging digital tool simply because the fear of it breaking and your inability to handle the subsequent emotional fallout is too high. You play it incredibly safe, and the instruction becomes sterile.
By upgrading their SEC, the training fundamentally removed the terror of the glitch.
Because they knew they had the internal emotional tools to mediate a crisis, they were willing to experiment. They became more dynamic, engaging instructors because the safety net was finally there.
This makes me realize we have been treating professional anxiety completely backward for decades.
What do you mean?
When teachers or corporate employees get overwhelmed by technology, the institutional response is almost always binary. We either say, let's mandate 5 more hours of software training.
Or we say, this is too stressful, let's rip the tech out and simplify everything.
Exactly. We try to solve an internal psychological problem by manipulating the external environment. But maybe the complexity of the tech isn't the actual problem.
The problem is that we are sending people into a high-friction environment with a completely outdated internal operating system.
Instead of trying to smooth out the entire world, we just need to upgrade the human's ability to handle the bumps.
That is perhaps the most profound systemic takeaway from this research. Modifying the external environment is a losing battle. The technology will only become more complex.
The multimodal demands will only increase.
And the human interactions will remain unpredictable. Providing a slightly more user-friendly interface does not cure the fundamental vulnerability of guiding a group of humans through a learning process.
So treating emotional intelligence not as a soft secondary trait, but as a core, accessible, vital professional competency is the only sustainable way to build resilience.
In any high-stakes communication profession, yes.
So let's bring this all the way home for the listener. Because unless you are currently grading English papers in Tehran, the specifics of ELT microteaching might seem abstract.
But the invisible architecture of this study is entirely relevant to you.
Think about your own week. Think about the last time you had to run a complicated hybrid meeting.
You had 3 people in a conference room, 4 people on a video call.
You were trying to share a financial spreadsheet that wouldn't format correctly, and the CEO just asked a question that wasn't on the agenda.
Your success in that exact moment, whether that meeting ended in a clear strategy or fragmented into a chaotic waste of time, was not determined by your Excel skills.
It was determined entirely by your SEC mediator. It was your emotional regulation when the spreadsheet froze, preventing you from snapping at the IT guy.
It was your empathy when you realized the people dialing in remotely couldn't hear the CEO clearly and were feeling alienated.
And it was your interpersonal communication when you seamlessly paused the presentation, verbally summarized the missing data, and re-engaged the remote team.
The multimodal demands created the friction, but your internal suspension system dictated the outcome.
If you don't have that system, you barrel through the presentation, your heart rate at 120 beats per minute, the remote team checks out, and the CEO thinks you can't handle pressure.
The mechanism is identical to the 24-year-old trainee trying to teach vocabulary.
We have covered massive ground today. We started with the physiological panic of the modern presentation and unpacked the cognitive heavy lifting required in a multimodal environment.
We discovered that social-emotional competence regulation, empathy, communication, is the vital suspension system that absorbs the shock of digital chaos.
We saw rigorous proof that this system is not a genetic lottery, but a highly trainable skill that can transform professionals in weeks.
And we explored how our socialized backgrounds like gender give us different starting tools. But the ultimate goal is building a complete, holistic resilience.
It fundamentally reshapes our definition of expertise. An expert is no longer just the person who holds the most knowledge.
It is the person who can maintain their humanity and connection when the delivery systems for that knowledge break down.
But as we wrap up this analysis, considering this deep need for emotional scaffolding, there is a lingering, somewhat provocative implication regarding where technology is actually heading.
There is indeed.
I know you always have a final thread to pull. What is the thought you want to leave us with?
Consider the billions of dollars currently being poured into the development of AI tutors and hyper-advanced educational tech.
Oh, right. The ultimate goal of Silicon Valley is to create a perfectly optimized, glitch-free, multimodal learning environment.
Exactly. An AI that never drops an audio feed, never gets frustrated, and perfectly tailors the visual input to the user.
But if we look at the core of this research,
if human teachers currently rely on their social-emotional competence specifically to navigate the friction and vulnerability of learning alongside a student, what happens when we succeed in engineering all the friction out of the room? If a student is interacting with a perfectly smooth, emotionally sterile AI that requires no empathy to manage, do we accidentally rob the learner of the shared human vulnerability that makes communication meaningful?
Because does learning a language or mastering any complex skill lose its profound human impact when there is no longer a human on the other side of the screen mediating the struggle?
It's a huge question.
If there is no pothole, there is no need for the suspension system.
Mm-hmm.
If there is no friction, there is no need for empathy. And if we strip empathy out of the learning process, are we even really communicating anymore, or are we just downloading data?
Exactly.
That is an incredible question to chew on. The next time you are standing at the front of a room or staring into that little green webcam light and your perfectly planned slide deck spectacularly crashes, take a breath. Don't panic.
Because that glitch, that exact moment of friction, might just be your greatest opportunity to actually connect as a human being.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
Yeah.
Take that thought with you, keep examining the world around you, and we will catch you next time.